Welcome to our special 7 questions edition of How to Win a Campaign. I am Martin Diego Garcia, and you can find us at the Campaign Workshop on Instagram or on Threads. In this series, we're talking to some of our favorite authors, content creators, and influencers, and you can find the 7 questions blog that inspired this conversation at thecampaignworkshop.com or in our show notes. I am super excited because today our guest is Daniel Hernandez, who's a dear friend and someone I've known for a while. So excited to have him on. Right, too long. So Daniel was born and raised in Tucson, Arizona. He is a first generation college student who attended the University of Arizona, and while in college, interned for then Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and was the first to administer first aid to her on that day of the tragic attack on her life. Daniel was inspired by Congresswoman Giffords' commitment to public service, and he ran for office and was elected to the local school board, became the youngest school board president in the district's history. I do remember that. Starting in 2017, Daniel then went on to serve at the Arizona State House as one of the youngest members ever elected. And as a representative, Daniel co-founded the House LGBTQ Caucus and worked with both Republicans and Democrats to pass bills to protect survivors of sexual assault. He also worked to secure over $20 million for counselors and social workers to help pass a bipartisan budget to invest in K-12 funding in Arizona. Daniel is currently serving as the Government Affairs Director at Stand for Children in Arizona. Daniel, so much, but thank you for joining
us.
I'm
a very old 33.
I was gonna say, you've done so much.
Wizened, old crone, geriatric millennial. I think I'm geriatric millennial.
Oh, I'm definitely a geriatric millennial. So we start most of these conversations because our listeners, we want to sort of show them the breadth and depth of the different ways that they can get involved in politics. Can you take us back and talk to us a little bit about how you got started in politics?
Yeah, it was 2008. I was sitting in a high school history class, American history, and I was looking around the room and there was a bunch of older white men staring back at me. They all happened to have been former presidents. So I asked my teacher, who was the AP American government teacher, when was the last time a woman was president? And he said, well, that's never going to happen because women are too emotional to be president. And I said, oh, well, if women can't be president, when was the last time a man of color was president? He said, well, that's not going to happen for a long time either. Sorry, I got the year wrong. It was 2007 leading into 2008. And I didn't really like that answer. So a couple months later, when Hillary Clinton, then senator from New York, announced that she was running for president, said, I don't know anything about politics, but I do not accept the premise that women are too emotional to be president, because as we are seeing in this current fight happening in the Congress, the people that seem to be incapable of being leaders are the men in Congress, because Nancy Pelosi had no problems counting. And yet we keep seeing men after man losing the speakership, John Boehner, all of the other men that have come since. So I signed up on the website not knowing what to expect. I was a very nerdy 17/18-year-old and really loved reading the news, but didn't understand politics. My family was completely apolitical. My dad hadn't voted in 20 years until I made him re-register to vote in 2008. My mom didn't become a citizen until 2016. So fun fact, she's never voted for me because she wasn't eligible to vote for me any of the races that I ran for election. And I got a call from a group of older Jewish women who happened to be the leaders for the Hillary campaign here in Southern Arizona. They affectionately call themselves the Yentas for Hillary. They took me under their wing and showed me all the naughty Yiddish and Hebrew words that you're not supposed to say in front of polite company.
Oh my God, I love that.
But more importantly, what they taught me was the value and the importance of building community and relationships. So I started going to events, started knocking on doors. I got the political bug. I went from wanting to go to medical school and wanting to help people by going into medicine to going on a path where I started lobbying at 18 at the Arizona State House. By the time I was 20, I passed my first piece of legislation and disappointed my parents more by coming out as I no longer want to be a medical student than coming out as gay. Because when I switched my majors, I think that was more devastating than anything that had ever happened to them before. And at 20, changed my major. I started working as a volunteer and then eventually an intern for Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. And it was funny because the same women who had been the Yentas for Hillary then became the Yentas for Gabby when Hillary dropped out of that race in 2008. So it's been a really interesting way for me to get there. I'm now a part of a political family that includes 3 state reps, because I was a state representative, my sister Alma was a state representative, and now my sister Consuelo is a state representative. So we went from my mom not being a citizen, my dad not voting in 20 years, to now three of the kids have been state elected officials, and we all got elected under 30 to the legislature.
Just phenomenal. I love it. Make sure you get the facts right. It's just amazing. I've been following you for a majority of your career, and then
sorry,
when I saw
it's right, like annoying, I'm sure.
No. And then like to see your sisters come up, I was like, this is great. You're like creating this own little dynasty there.
Alma and I were the first brother and sister to serve in the legislature.
I remember.
And now my
that.
Sisters are the first sisters to serve in the legislature, because there's been mothers and sons, daughters and father, but never siblings. So we're really excited. And if nothing else, we've been able to have that little footnote in Arizona state history.
Always. So take us back and talk to us a little bit about your experience interning for Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. What was that like?
It was an interesting time. So I had two different experiences, because I had the internship on the campaign and then I had the internship in the congressional office. So the campaign was intense, exhausting, and emotionally draining over the period of a year, where the internship in the congressional office literally was 5 days long. Because I was the fifth day of my internship in the congressional office when the shooting happened. So that experience was all of those things, but in a very protracted schedule and timeline. And I think for me, when I started interning in the congressional campaign, I wanted to just get to know her and get to know the people around her. So I became that ubiquitous teenager that everybody hates, but they also love, because they'll do whatever you need them to. So anything they needed, I showed up and I did. I didn't have a car at the time, so my parents had to drive me, which meant that you didn't just get me a lot of the time, you got my entire family. So I think when we were going and doing things, I was the Spanish speaker. I was the one that they turned to, or, hey, we want someone who's not 40 in the room. You're 18, come to this. So it was a really interesting experience, because I got exposed to a lot of people and a lot of things that I never would have had the opportunity to do otherwise. So I think one of my first pieces of advice to people is go and volunteer on a campaign, because if you show up enough, people will start giving you responsibilities and things to do. And it's a really interesting experience, because you're learning things by doing, as opposed to being in a classroom and being told, here is how government works. Here's how campaigns work. Here's a, you know, PhD dissertation on how to win a campaign. It's like, we need you to go knock on doors. We need you to stuff envelopes. We need you to do this. We need you to do that. So the congressional campaign was really interesting, because it was my first foray into being a campaign volunteer other than the Hillary stuff. And the Hillary stuff was really different, because she was an ephemeral figure. She wasn't someone that I could touch or see or talk to. And I actually didn't meet Secretary Clinton until she was Secretary of State. And after the shooting, I got invited to meet with her one-on-one in her office. Gabby was someone that I could like ask a question to and be annoying in her face and be like, why do you people do this? What is going on here? And that's, I think, something that I've come to appreciate so much, that when you work with candidates and you volunteer, you're talking to people as people. You're not seeing, you know, the scripted thing that people want to see on TV that are campaign consultants. No offense to Martine. You're getting the like unvarnished, raw, they're exhausted, and you're staffing them at an event and all they want is a Diet Coke and they're just burnt out. And you get to see people kind of in a really kind of primal and raw way when you're working and spending a lot of time with them. And I think that's so important, because then you get to see like, what kind of person is this really? Is this someone that should be in office? And for the most part, you know, in the interactions that I've had with candidates, I've learned the most just from being around and like observing and just kind of being that person that's like, I'm just watching and seeing how you interact with other human beings. Are you rude to servers? Are you rude to the barista? Like those kinds of things. Because I think if nothing else, for me, my family has placed upon this belief that everyone has something to contribute to make the world a better place. And it could be a small thing or it could be a big thing, but we all have something and we should all treat each other with respect and, you know, make sure that we're being nice to each other. And that was something that Gabby also impressed upon us, because she said, whether somebody's 8 years old or 80, you treat them well and you treat them with respect, because they are all people that deserve to be respected.
She's quite inspiring. I have now got to meet her a couple of times only because we work with Giffords as well. And so getting to see how she turned that into such a huge conversation and now what is a really powerful organization. Can you talk a little bit about how both her commitment to public service sort of impacted you. But in addition, right, like how that particular incident of you being sort of the first person when it happened sort of impacted your life as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important for people to know is in my family, our grandmother taught us a really important lesson that was in Spanish, which is pondo granito de arena, which for you non-Spanish speakers means putting in your grain of sand. It was this thing that she taught to all of her 80 plus grandchildren, which was that no matter how big or how small, we all have something to contribute to make the world a better place. And at first, I thought that the way of doing that would be going into healthcare and trying to help people one-on-one. As I got a little bit older and I started working on campaigns, particularly working for Gabby's campaign, I learned the power of being a voice for those who didn't have one. I think growing up in a very loud Mexican family, I didn't understand the concept of people not being able to speak up for themselves. But when I started working for her, learning and understanding that people need advocates, she's actually the one that talked to me about the idea of advocacy and lobbying. And it was after working for her as a congressional campaign intern that I did my first advocacy internship. So at 18, I started going to the Arizona State Capitol and learning more about policy. So when I shifted and said, I'm no longer wanting to go into healthcare, I want to be an advocate, it was because I had passed my first piece of legislation at 20. And I wasn't a high-paid lobbyist. I was a student who really believed in the right to vote and in democracy. And we had passed protections and made it easier for young people to be able to vote. But when we did that, I realized that the impact that I could have was so much greater than one-on-one as a physician or as somebody in healthcare, because the bill that I passed now impacted 250,000 Arizona students at the three state universities. And then after the shooting, I said, you know, this cemented in me the desire to try and be an advocate and take that voice and that advocacy work that I'd been doing before, but now focus it in a different way, because now there are six people who are murdered who don't have a voice anymore. And I saw it as my responsibility to try and be a voice for those who were taken from us on January 8th of 2011. I think one of the other things was I envisioned in my mind going to work for somebody like Gabby or for Gabby herself on Capitol Hill after I finished at the University of Arizona, but now being in the spotlight and thankfully not messing it up too bad. There were plenty of mistakes, I'm sure, that were made by me, but being able to speak to what was happening and the issues, particularly around gun violence, I said, you know, maybe all this time I've been thinking about helping other people because I was afraid of being the one out in front. And now that I'm out in front, I'm realizing that maybe I should be the one doing these things. So I was approached in June of 2011 because I'd already been lobbying at the Arizona State Legislature on higher education issues by several people in my community to run for the school board in Sunnyside. I was still at the University of Arizona. I was only 3 years graduated from high school. So it was a very bizarre thing. And I said, I don't know anything about being on a school board. I don't know anything about elected office. But I'm willing to learn and I'm willing to work hard. And I think that was the thing that was such an important thing, that I didn't come in thinking I knew everything. I was fully informed about being completely ignorant about all of the things that had to do with schools and with the school district. So the shooting really cemented in me my desire to continue to serve and to help advocate, but in a very different way, because now that I was out in front, I realized that I had a powerful voice that I could use to help others and not just work behind the scenes like I always thought I would when I moved over to the advocacy world.
So you've now sort of read in school boards and in your state legislature. And as we're seeing right now, the political landscape is not letting anybody get anything done. Could you talk a little bit about sort of what it was like for you, particularly in the House of Representatives, to work across the aisle, to work with both your party and Republicans in getting actual legislation passed?
So here's the fun thing. I got elected at 26. I was one of the youngest members ever elected to the Arizona State House. But despite the fact that I was one of the youngest member ever elected, I already had 8 sessions under my belt before I even started. So it was this really funny cognitive dissonance for a lot of folks that, like, I have a lot of experience, but I'm also a third their age in some instances. So it was really funny because I think the biggest thing that I had to overcome was this idea that I was young and I didn't know what I was talking about. And I think part of what I had to learn to do was kind of own my space and get my colleagues to understand that, yes, I may be 26 and you have a kid that's my age or younger, but I actually am the same vote that you are here in this building. And there are 60 of us and we all share equal responsibilities to our constituents. So you're not going to just write me off and ignore me because I'm younger and you have to listen to what I say. And it was really funny because the people that I think actually were the hardest to work with were my Democratic colleagues, because so many of them had been there for so long in the minority that they had this, and I don't want to say this in a disparaging way, but this mentality of permanent minority. Like they weren't out there trying to get us into the majority and they weren't thinking strategically on how do they actually move legislation. It was, well, we're in the minority and the Republicans don't want to give us anything, so we don't actually have to try. We're just going to drop a bunch of bills that aren't going to go anywhere and that's fine. And I came in and I'm like, I am not here to sit on my laurels and get nothing done. So the very first thing that I did was I started meeting with my new Republican colleagues. I had several relationships from before, but I started meeting with them because I knew that the only way to get things done, being in the minority in the Arizona State House and being one of four openly gay members and the youngest member of the legislature, would be by building relationships. So I took them to lunch. I took them to coffee. I got to know who their kids were. One of the things that I like to share is I used to go on an annual dove hunt with my Republican colleagues. There's a farmer in Yuma County, which is on the Arizona-Mexico border. And every October, he would host a dove hunt where he would invite all 90 members. And every year, there was maybe two or three Democrats that would come. And it was usually me and my sisters that would come because as much as I, you know, work on gun violence prevention, I'm a better shot than most of the Republicans, which always surprises them. But it also allowed me to show them that I'm not the big, scary, gay liberal who's trying to take their guns away. Instead, I'm the serious policymaker who's willing to come and drive, you know, 4 hours to get to know you and your family and build that relationship. And there were a lot of times where my colleagues on the Republican side would tell me, I can't vote with you for this reason, but I know why you're doing this. And a lot of people don't consider that a win. But the fact that they're at least aware that what they're doing is wrong was a win for me because it was losing forward. Because now we had people who at a human level were at least starting to recognize that some of the things that were being pushed by some of their advocacy groups on the far right, particularly the Arizona Center for Arizona Policy, a far right-wing think tank that's been working on a lot of anti-LGBTQ legislation. The fact that they're now stopping and pausing and saying, like, I need to ask this person and this organization questions was a win in a lot of times because I was talking to conservative Republican Christians who are now pushing back on the talking points and the stuff that they were getting. And there were a couple times where I haven't really talked about this too much, but the bills wouldn't make it to the floor because the people who I had built relationships with said, if it gets on the floor, I'm going to have to vote for it. So I'm just going to make sure it doesn't make it to the House floor. And that was a win.
Totally, right? Like, what a different strategy to think about in terms of like stopping legislation. This is like relying on their like moral compass to be like, well, I don't want to be on the record doing this. So let's just make sure we don't have to actually take a vote on it.
Exactly. And I think one huge win for me that was really meaningful was in 2019, I was approached because there was a bill that had been passed in 1991. We affectionately called it the No Promo Homo Bill. So at the height of the AIDS crisis, a bill was passed to talk about HIV education because there was obviously not a lot of great information about AIDS in the 90s, especially in 1991 when this got passed. So what the compromise was, because this was the compromise that could be done similar to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you can only do as much as the political reality. It was, we will teach kids about HIV and AIDS so that they hopefully don't get it. But as a part of that, we also have to say that you cannot talk about the homosexual community, because if you talk about them, that's promoting homosexuality and homosexuality is inherently bad. So because it was in the education laws, even though it had to specifically do with HIV and AIDS education, the way that it was being interpreted by school districts was any mention of the LGBTQ community could put our funding at stake. So we're just going to pretend that they don't exist. So from 1991 to 2019, schools were not allowed to talk about the LGBTQ community or even acknowledge that they existed, because if they did, somebody could file a report and then an investigation would happen. And if they were shown to have been promoting a homosexual lifestyle, which was the verbiage in the legislature that got passed in 91, they could have their funding be affected. So when that happened, I was 1 year old. When we repealed the law in a very, very strong bipartisan showing, I think it was 55, if I'm not mistaken, out of 60 House Democrats and Republicans that voted to repeal it, and 21 out of 30 senators. That didn't happen because I had a ton of power as the LGBTQ caucus chair. That happened because I built relationships. And when the moment was right and I was able to build the power over 3 years of serving in the legislature, we were able to pounce on an opportunity. And we repealed it in 2019, which then meant that we could at least start having a conversation about the existence of LGBTQ community. We will have to have longer conversations about how to do it the right way. But the fact that we're not being prohibited from having that conversation is a huge win. And honestly, one of the things that I'm the proudest of during my tenure at the legislature.
That is fantastic. I mean, we talk about relationships and sort of the key to them, and really all organizing, right, is understanding what makes people tick, understanding their motivations, right? Like looking at them as humans and being able to have those hard conversations with folks. Do you talk a little bit about, right, like being the youngest school board president in the district's history, one of the youngest representatives? You talked about sort of being young in the legislature. Can you speak a little bit to why being a young elected official is important, why we need more of them, and how do you advocate for yourself once you're in office? I think we continue to work with the LGBTQ Victory Institute on training folks, and we're getting a lot of younger folks coming in who want to step up and run for office. So any insight you would give these folks?
I am often reminded of a quote when I have this kind of conversation with folks, which is Golda Meir, the first female prime minister of Israel, who used to say, "Don't be so humble, you're not that great." So I'm always kind of tempted to be self-effacing, and I think a little bit self-deprecating when people ask me this. But I think the biggest thing is you have to own your experience, and you may not have as long of an experience as other folks, especially those who are, you know, twice or even in some cases three times your age. But we have an experience that's important, and we have to live with the consequences of the decisions being made, whether or not we're at the decision-making table. So we either live with the consequences of the decisions being made by people in their 70s and 80s who will not be around for the next 50 years to deal with the issues around gun violence, the climate, you know, the economy. These are all decisions that are going to impact us for the long term, but these are being made by decision makers who are there for the short term. So I think the first part is realizing that we have a really important voice and stake in the conversation, because we're going to be impacted for this long term. And we need to make sure that we understand, and that we also have a little bit of humility, that when we do come into a room, we do have a story and an experience to tell, but we're also probably not the expert in the room. And we have to acknowledge that sometimes we may get things wrong, but being able to admit that you're wrong and that you're learning is an important part of being an elected official if you're going to be a good policymaker. Because I think there's a couple of different tracks for elected officials. There's the fire breathers who go on social media and love to yell and scream and then get on cable news. There's the people who are just the workhorses who put their heads down and you wouldn't be able to pick them out of the crowd. And then there's the people who I think, and I'm somewhere kind of in the middle, who can be the fire breather when needed, because there's some times where you have to go out there and shout and be the speaker at the rally. But then also realize that, like, your job is to be a representative or a school board member or a senator. Your job is to represent your constituents, not to be out there and getting all the glory for yourself.
It is a good reminder to folks that, one, what you bring is important, right? And two, make sure that you know what you know and know what you don't know. So, no, you have won and lost in the world of politics, so the campaign trail, and I would imagine in actually doing the job in the legislature. How do you stay inspired to continue to be in this work, right, in the different ways in which you are involved? What keeps you motivated?
Oh, my goodness. One of the biggest things for me that has been a strong motivator is the fact that you could be the first, but make sure you're not the last. And that we always have to work to try and build up the next generation of leaders, whether they're younger than us or people that are older than us. The next generation doesn't necessarily get defined by just people's ages, but it's about bringing in new people into the fold and into the decision-making process. So one of my passions has been helping get other people elected, helping train people, helping support candidates. And I'm not just talking about like going and giving them $50, which is always nice, and you should always give to candidates. But it has meant sitting and doing call time with candidates and giving them feedback. It's been going and knocking on doors with candidates around the state and in some cases around the country, and really helping people understand, what is your why? Why are you wanting to do this? And if your reason is, well, I want a stable salary and I want to be on TV every once in a while, probably not somebody that you want to help get elected to office. But the people who are really passionate about a specific issue or a specific thing that happened to them, those are the things that help me get motivated, because I've had a lot of interesting experiences at 33, but a lot of them have come as a result of me taking any trauma or pain and turning it into action and saying, I have a responsibility to make the world a better place, and I'm not always going to get it right, but I do have a responsibility to try. And I also love to learn. And I think there's nothing more interesting or informative than being an elected official, because when I was a school board member, I had no idea about how to manage staff. And at 24, became the school board president when we had a huge corruption issue. And then I had 1,500 staff reporting to me because I was a board president and I was directly managing staff who were two or three times my age. That was a big hands-on learning experience where I'm sure we made mistakes, but we wanted to do the best thing for the kids that were still in school. And I think the only other thing that I would say is, for me, this idea that our grandmother taught us of putting in your grain of sand has also been a big motivator, that we all have something to contribute to make things better. And that means, you know, putting in your little granito de arena, your little grain of sand to try and make things better. So it's always a strong motivator. That's why even though I'm not in elected office right now, I'm still working really diligently to try and make things better for Arizona and for people around the country.
And before we get to what you're doing now, I think I know the answer to this, but so you ran for school board, you were school board president, right? You were in the legislature, ran for Congress. I don't know if you plan on running again, but was it worth it, right? Like, was serving in office, running, raising the money,
so
knocking on the doors?
I had come out at 22, so I'm really well-versed in looking back and, you know, having these great dialogues about, you know, the memoirs of my youth. I'm totally being sarcastic and kidding, by the way. I think for me, there are so many things that I've done that sometimes it's kind of shocking to me looking back, and people will remind me of some of the things that I've done. But it's a good reminder that there's still a lot of work left to be done. And the fact that I still look forward and say, like, here's so many other things that I have to do and that I have to work on, is a strong motivator for me to, like, stay engaged and involved. Because I can't tell you how easy it would have been to take a high-paying corporate job, because I did get offered a couple of those after, you know, my years of elected office. And I said, no, I'm going to focus on trying to improve the lives of the kids in Arizona. So I stayed in Arizona and continued to work on education, which has been one of my biggest and most important issues ever since I was young, because I've seen the power, the transformative power of education, because both my sisters and I have not only been first-generation college students, we now all have masters, and my sister Alma is in law school. So we've seen how important and potent the power of education is to people who, you know, came from really humble beginnings. And now two of the most important legislators in the Democratic side of the aisle in Arizona are my sisters. And that doesn't just happen. It happens because they've learned, they've done a lot, but they've also learned that there's a lot of work left to be done.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that a little bit. So now you're serving as the government affairs director at Stanford Children in your home state of Arizona. Talk to us a little bit about the organization's mission, right? Like your role and what are you all trying to achieve there?
So Stanford Children is a unique catalyst that works on not just educational equity, but also racial equity. So we don't only just work on education issues, although that's a large part of what I do. We also work on doing things like removing barriers for young kids who've been wrapped up into the criminal justice system. This year, we passed a bill that eliminated fees at the courts for juveniles, because Arizona was one of the worst states in the country where if you had issues with law enforcement when you were young, even if you were found not guilty, you were getting charged fees. And then if you didn't pay them because you couldn't afford to, it turned into a civil penalty against you. So by the time you turned 18, you could enter into adulthood already having a credit report that's shot, not only having any judicial and, you know, legal issues from the courts, but also your credit is shot. So applying for student loans, applying for housing, applying for some jobs would have been really difficult. So I've been working with Stan now for a little over a year. We have a really ambitious agenda that includes protecting public education funding in Arizona, because we have unvarnished growth of the voucher system here that has just gotten out of hand. It's blowing almost a $1 billion hole into the state budget. So we're working on protecting funding, protecting kids from, you know, the real threats, which are not drag queens, but instead it's not being able to teach history that is reflective of the reality. It's messy, it's difficult, but it's the history of our country, and we need to be able to address it so that kids can move forward and learn from it. And I think one of the things that I'm really excited about is we're working to not only elect strong education candidates, but once they're in office, making sure we're holding people accountable and saying to our friends, now that you have power, we need you to use it to make sure that we're materially improving the lives of the kids in Arizona.
What great work. And I'm super inspired that you were continuing to stay there in your home state, doing the work day in and day out. So kudos to you. So last question we ask everybody as well. What are some of your favorite podcasts, books, movies, TV shows you're digging into right now?
Well, I love listening to this podcast. I have actually listened to some episodes.
We did not pay him to say that.
No, I think if I'm being 100% honest, I did take a little bit of a step back from political podcasts, because after 11 years as an elected official and being on the congressional campaign trail for 18 months, all I consumed was political. So in August of last year, I went on my first vacation in a very long time where I didn't do anything other than just enjoy myself and have fun. But when I got back, one of the things that I started doing was reading for fun again for the first time in a very long time. I used to love reading when I was a child. I was the kid that was on the baseball field with a book underneath my glove, not paying attention to the game, but reading a chapter book because I wanted to learn more. So I think the first thing that I've gotten into is reading for fun. So I'm actually right now reading Patrick Stewart's biography, Making It So. Patrick Stewart, famously of Star Trek, The Next Generation, Captain Picard, and also of X-Men. I'm also reading Maria Bamford's memoir, which is called Sure, I'll Join Your Cult. So I have severe ADD. So I can't just read one book at a time. But I love to read biographies and learning about other people's experiences and see if there's anything that is helpful to me. Podcasts that I'm listening to right now. So it ranges from the very gay to the very silly. So there's a podcast that's on the Mom Network of Podcasts, which is a bunch of drag queens and other queer creators. So it used to be called Unbearable, and now it's called Sloppy Seconds with Big Dipper and Meatball, which I listen to. It's a little not PG-13. It's probably a little bit more R-rated. So that's a fun podcast. And then the other podcast that I've started listening to a lot more is Why Won't You Date Me with Nicole Byer. Going from the literally only listening to podcasts about the news and politics to now being like, I need a detox. I need a break. It's been a long time. So let me have some fun. So those are the two things that I'm doing, reading for fun and listening to just ridiculous and funny and silly podcasts.
I love that. I mean, with the way the world is, you got to find joy somewhere. And if that's where it's at, hey, let's, I'm here for it. I'm here for it. Exactly. So where can folks connect with you, learn what you're doing, figure out more about Stanford Children? Talk to us a little bit about how they can get in contact with you.
Yeah. So the best way of getting a hold of me is on almost every social media. It's Daniel4AZ. Facebook wouldn't let me have that. So it's DanielHernandez.AZ on Facebook, but everywhere else on Twitter or /X, and then also Threads and Instagram, although I'm not on TikTok because I am too old for TikTok, even though most of my friends are on it constantly. And I think the other thing that I would say is if anyone is ever interested in running for office, obviously there are a lot of great workshops to attend. I met Martin at one through the Victory Institute back in 2011, and it's such a wonderful resource, and the campaign workshop does really wonderful trainings and support. But I'm always happy to reach out and do a Zoom call, or if I'm in your area, do a coffee, because I think one of the things that I've been most passionate about is helping get other people into elected office who are from underrepresented communities, whether they be women, LGBTQ, people from minorities, or just, you know, low income folks, because these are all voices that deserve to be heard and be at the table.
Appreciate that. And Daniel, thank you so much for being on with us and for all of the work that you were doing. You continue to inspire me, and we are lucky to have you.
Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll see you in San Francisco.
Yes. For more on this topic, check out our blog at thecampaignworkshop.com. If you want to hear more of these interviews, be sure to like, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, I am Martin Diego Garcia, breaking down how to win a campaign.
How to Win a Campaign is Joe Fold, Martin Diego Garcia, Elizabeth Rowe, Phoebe Retta, Samantha Sondek, and Lauren Odom. Music by Danielle Pinto. Audio editing by Christopher Lang. Special thanks to the team at the Campaign Workshop. Please review, like, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.